Well, thank you, everyone. Thanks, Steve. It's a real pleasure to be here. And Steve was clearly well ahead of his time in working on here on oxides in the 1980s, because the first time I gave this talk, a younger colleague of mine looked at me and said, you know, how on earth can you justify the use of new in that title? Because I've spent my entire research career working on these things. And so I thought, well, I should probably give you a bit of justification for that. And what I mean by new is that as an undergraduate at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland in the 1980s, I was indeed exposed a little bit to the science of oxides. But the science I was told about was the science of these things. I was taught some geology, and so I was taught about rocks. And if you look back at the undergraduate physics curriculum in the 1980s, at least in Scotland, oxides didn't figure at all. They just weren't thought to be part of mainstream physics. And because of the, largely because of the discovery of high TC superconductivity that Steve just mentioned, that has completely changed over the last 25 years. And really, this is then, in some senses, meant to be a status report of the progress in that field. I also want to apologize in advance to my condensed matter colleagues, because I've tried to stick to the ethos of a colloquium, and this talk is mainly addressed to people outside the field rather than people within it. And so bear with me, and I hope it's not too boring for the experts. So what I'll do is I'll talk to you a little bit about the challenge of the more general correlated electron problem. That's a problem that doesn't just involve oxides, but I believe that oxides are one of the fundamentally best choices of materials with which to use to study that problem. And then I'll talk to you about what high-temperature superconductivity brought us. It's brought us fantastic refinement of single crystals and thin films. I'll talk a little bit about the way that you can use those new single crystals and thin films to do forms of fundamental physics to do with the correlated electron problem. And I'll also give one particular example that I've worked on, which is one of these sort of cross-field, border-crossing pieces of work that nobody expected, least of all us, which is that there appear now to be ground states of correlated electron systems also in oxides, where the correlated electrons themselves develop forms of order whose order parameters had previously been written down in classical physics associated with liquid crystals. Then I'll try and give you a few conclusions and thoughts for the future. So what about the correlated electron problem? Well, I believe that it's intellectually the challenge of it comes from this really major challenge for the coming century, which is the study in general of complex systems. And it's a funny term, because it's not the complexity which is the surprise or the beautiful thing, it's the amazing simplicity that can come out of some of these collective states. And this is a level of simplicity both in classical physics and quantum physics that we probably don't have a right to expect, and understanding why it's arising is a major challenge to us all. When we're thinking about classical physics bringing this, then you think about things like aspects of biology. This idea of emergence of simplicity is very important. Soft condensed matter, telephone networks, financial systems. Now, in financial systems, you can get to a very simply defined state if you're not careful. It may not be one you wanted to reach, but it's an example of sort of a catastrophically simple endpoint of complex behavior. In quantum physics, it's being studied in a variety of fields. Anybody who's looked at a heavy ion collider will realize that you're studying many body physics in these quark gluon plasmas and the kind of super hot, very complicated products of collisions in that. Collisions of ions with many, many nucleons per ion. It's atomic physics, as is well known in this department, gives you a fantastic playground for doing certain types of experiments on the problem. And what I would call hard condensed matter, in other words, quantum as opposed to purely H bar equals zero condensed matter physics, notably the strongly correlated electron systems that of which the oxide physics I'm going to talk about forms a part. So I think and one of the funny things about condensed matter physics is that it's always it's a little bit unsure of where it's going, because At one hand, it has tremendous challenges in fundamental work, so you can address a lot of fundamental problems in the field. On the other hand, you tell governments, and there's even some truth to it, that there is the promise of applications coming out of this fundamental work that you're doing. And so I come very much from the end of the spectrum where we, in my group, we play around to enjoy ourselves. We don't have a direct technological goal at all, but it's fun to keep an eye on how the technology is developing and see what the possibilities might be. And that's the kind of motif that I'm going to try and get through during the talk, going from fundamental work to applied work and back to fundamental work again, to give you a flavor for the field as a whole. So with that in mind, here's my first few comments about technology. So the computer I'm using to give the talk, the beamer up above you, is all based really on semiconductors, and more specifically, it's based probably dominantly on the physics of silicon. So you had an elemental semiconductor that you were able to make to extremely high levels of purity. You were able to make heterostructures with materials with similar lattice parameters, and you are able to do almost all of the technology was due to the exquisitely externally tunable conductivity of these semiconductors when they were controlled as precisely as possible. However, there have been some extremely interesting physics, such as the physics of metal insulator transitions and now the physics of ferromagnetism in dilute magnetic semiconductors that's coming out. And with it being the semiconductor industry, some devices are already around that are based on both of these phenomena. Okay. So with oxides, you can one of the things technologically that's interesting is that you can do the same thing. You have, again, materials with very similar lattice parameters, and I'll show you later that gives you the opportunity to think of epitaxial games that you can play with various materials in heterostructures. They will also give you externally tunable conductivity, not as exquisitely tunable as semiconductors. They'll also give you metal insulators and transitions and ferromagnetism. So if that was where the story stopped with oxides, frankly, there wouldn't be a lot of point technologically in continuing because you can do all that with semiconductors already. But with oxides, you can also see antiferromagnetism. You can see ferrimagnetism, superconductivity, superconductor insulator transitions, charge and spin texturing. You can play quantum critical games that are harder to play in semiconductors. And once you have these quantum critical points, you can get associated giant response functions that you believe you might be able to make use of technologically. So in the oxide game, in the semiconductor game, it's a very mature business. It's a mature technology. So almost all the key physical properties are already being used in devices sold by major companies. In oxides, this is all potential, and a little bit of that potential has been realized, but not very much yet. And part of today's talk is going to be to assess whether there's any prospect of that happening in future. I mean, one can never tell, but I hope that by the end of the talk, you come away somewhat surprised about at least the material quality with which oxides can now be made, and that material quality, just as in the semiconductors, material quality was everything. Improving the material quality of oxides, I think, is an absolutely vital step to eventually using them. It's also a vital step towards being able to find out some of the most interesting physical properties and exposing some of the most interesting quantum collective phenomena. So whether you're a technologist or a pure scientist, you should have the same basic goals in mind at this stage of the development of the field. So, been mentioned by Steve and myself in the introduction. Before this material, this family of materials, the high-temperature superconductors, came along, you would have been thought to be completely mad as a physicist to want to work on something with this level of complexity. There are many atoms per unit cell. They're layered compounds, which is nice. They would typically have some transition metal atoms with copper playing the most popular role as the key iron in this structure to lead to high-temperature superconductivity. You then have complex oxygen structures around them, other transition and rare earth metals, separator layers. At a time when Kittel was concentrating on sodium in his book and other people were concentrating on silicon, we weren't frankly, probably ready to deal with oxides of this complexity when the phenomenon was discovered. And any of us, which includes Steve and myself, who were around in the early days of HITC, it took 5 years even to know where we were, 5 years to be able to get any reliable experimental results that would subsequently be still quoted today. And that was simply because of the sheer complexity of the chemistry and material science that we physicists were having to get to know and understand in order to work in the field. However, a lot of progress has been made since then, and it's still such an active and vibrant, shall we say, field that you can get into trouble by drawing any kind of a phase diagram for the cuprates. Somebody's going to argue with you about some detail of it, but everybody would agree on the general picture that you have, first of all, a dome as a function of chemical doping. You change the number of carriers on the copper-oxygen planes. There's a dome of superconductivity with an astonishingly high maximum transition temperature, which has caused all the interest. But you also now, we realize that there are very strange properties going on at the borderline between magnetism and between the magnetism and the superconductivity. There's some form of a semi or pseudo gap opening up in the excitation spectrum, which is still the subject of a lot of debate. There is now very good evidence that you can even take away the question mark, and that if you dope far enough, you get to a conventional metal, so that you have some opportunities for starting at the conventional metal, working back and trying to understand what's happening to the superconductivity at this low TC range. Up here, above the maximum superconducting transition temperature, though, you have what everybody will agree is a strange metal. It has properties that don't look at all like the properties of copper or gold or palladium or something, maybe a little bit more like palladium than the others. But just understanding the basic metallic electronic properties in this range of temperatures coming down at this doping is still to understand it and say you can have a theory that accounts for it is a big claim that will undoubtedly get you into trouble with 90% of your colleagues. And so we experimentally know a lot about this phase diagram, but the problem seems to be a profound one, and so there are major issues about the theoretical understanding of it, which we haven't cracked yet. But that's exciting. The main point, though, is that experimentally, 20 or 25 years on, we're beginning to get things under control, and we're at least able to categorize this almost bewilderingly complex family of oxides with real experimental accuracy. So one of the things that the HITC revolution spun off was, notably in Japan, was the development of exquisite methods for growing very large and very high purity single crystals of oxides. The ideas had existed before, but as is often the case, it takes high quality engineering to bring them to fruition and to turn them from the idea on a piece of paper into something which many people are using. So here I'm showing you a picture of, I'm going to show you a series of pictures of the instrument that was developed. And this is called an image furnace. And the reason for that is that each of these gold things, that's very highly high precision machine stainless steel, gold plated, and each of the two halves of this particular instrument is just over half of an ellipsoid. So that when you bring the two things together, instead of having two focal points, you have three focal points for the body that you've created. You put the filament of about a 1,000-watt light bulb at the two outer focal points, and your sample at the inner one, so that it's just the old principle of burning down your high school with a pile of leaves and a magnifying glass when you were a kid. You focus light, or dreaming thereof. You focus light, and all the power of the light couples extremely efficiently into the metallic oxide you're trying to create. And there's an almost perfect band gap of silicon oxide quartz for the tube. So the light goes straight through the edges of the tube. It goes straight through whatever gases you're using in there to control the chemistry. And it couples beautifully into your sample. When you close the thing and have it turned on, you can see this sort of warm glow. The warm glow is coming out of various sources of light leakage, mainly re-radiation from the sample, which can be sitting at anything up to 2,500 degrees in there, depending on how you've controlled it. Because you generally have a high pressure of gas at very high temperatures in this tube. You're absolutely not supposed ever to be able to take this photo because the thing's enclosed in a safety cage. I told the students they weren't to take it, but they went and took it anyway, and then I decided I could use it. The way you actually run the experiment, which again goes down well with the operators, is that you have a video camera here streaming the image of what you're seeing out to a computer, and there's a lot of controls that a skilled operator needs to be operating by hand, but they're doing that by hand from a keyboard, watching what's going on and doing a kind of human feedback into the growth process. Inside the furnace, everything's working well. What you'll be seeing on your screen is this is the image of the filaments, which is why it's called an image furnace. And here you have usually a cylindrical, props are all here, like a cylindrical stick of chalk, polycrystalline material in a cylinder. In the middle, where you see the thing necking in slightly, is molten material. You are counter-rotating the chalk at the top and with the crystal you're pulling out of the bottom of that molten material. So you have excellent mixing and flow going on in the molten zone. And the molten zone self-supports due to its own viscosity and surface tension. And so, basically, it's adopting the shape that a drop of water would adopt just before it bifurcates into two drops of water for the same reason. And a skilled operator knows how to keep the shape right and to control it. Depending on the kinetic parameters of what you're trying to grow, you can grow a crystal not far off the dimensions of that stick of chalk, which would be one single crystal. In some materials, you can grow that in a couple of hours. Those are the ones that tend to get studied in the Western world. In some other materials, it takes you 24 or 36 hours of constant monitoring to grow the crystal of the same size. And those are the ones that tend to get grown in the Eastern world, like in Japan, where the graduate students are prepared to put in the sacrifice necessary to be around their furnace for 36 hours. If I asked my graduate students to do that, that would not happen. But I was very struck a number of years ago to walk into the lobby of Bell Labs, the famous materials research lab in New Jersey. And, you know, out of Bell Labs had come several Nobel Prizes. They discovered the cosmic microwave background. It was, you know, this place full of all these legendary scientists publishing legendary papers. But the piece of equipment that they had right up front and center when you walked in was some equipment for zone refining silicon. So they knew absolutely that the most important invention ever made in that laboratory was the invention that allowed silicon to be purified and then led to the semiconductor revolution. So in some senses, we aren't there yet, but this furnace is playing something like the role of zone refining equipment in semiconductors. It allows you to grow large and extremely pure single crystals of oxides. Now, when two solid-state physicists are talking to each other, one of the things that they will generally do is to claim that their sample is better than their neighbor's. And so you've got two choices there. Either you can get involved in an unseemly fight about your opinion against somebody else's, or you try and come up with some objective measure to prove that your sample was, in fact, better than your neighbor's. And this doesn't work for everything, but it will work for any metal that you're trying to grow. And so if you're trying to grow a metal, going back to the days of Landau, it turns out that if you grow a metal and you have electrons free to move and you apply, let's imagine for now that they're free to move in two dimensions because the thinking's a little bit easier. So you have a two-dimensional electron gas and you apply a perpendicular magnetic field, then even in a classical system, you would be creating Larmor orbiting of those electrons. What Landau did was to quantize that solution, quantize that problem, and show that the solution in the quantum system is to go again into Larmor-like precessional orbits, but orbits which are quantized, so they can only exist with certain radii and certain energies. There's a picture of one of the wave functions. The most elegant solution, or the most elegant depiction of the Landau solution, came a little bit later from Ansager, and I think I found his original paper in the old St. Andrews Library once. And it's a beautiful quote from him. He wrote a short paper in which he noted that the orbit area, everything was going to be controlled by the orbit areas being on average of a size that they can threaded one flux quantum or an integer number of flux quanta in the existence of, in the presence of this external field. And I think that that was, of course, real space flux quantization has played an enormously important role in a variety of physical phenomena over the past 50 years. I think this is the first example of it. And there's a beautiful sentence there where he talks about recognizing a fundamental unit equal to the flux from one of Dirac's hypothetical magnetic poles. And so I don't think you would write a sentence like that if this was a mature field. It should be said that at about the same time, Lifshitz wrote some lecture notes in Russia that showed that he'd had the same insight and the two had not ever talked about them. But Ansager was persuaded to write these up by the experimental father of the field, David Schoenberg, when Ansager was on a sabbatical in Cambridge in 1951, I think, and it was published in 52. So the idea then is that if you have any system of fermions, whether they're the bare electrons or interesting many-body quasi-particles consisting of a superposition of many electrons, then they will, under the presence of a magnetic field, enter these Landau orbital states. And as you change the magnetic field, you're going to see signs of that quantization in the response of the signal to the system to that change. We'll give you some examples in a moment. Now, coming back to why it proves that my sample's better than yours, there's an evil exponential that comes into the theory of this thing, which is a damping factor which involves the cyclotron radius, in other words, how far these things are trying to go in real space, and the mean free path as a ratio in the argument of an exponential. And so we don't need to go into details. This is the only equation that I show in the talk. But basically, imagine you have a material which in the infinite impurity limit would give you an oscillatory property, usually a magnetization. It's a thermodynamic potential which oscillates because of the Landau quantization. That will then give you an infinite purity maximum signal that you could ever observe. What you're actually going to observe will be that intrinsic maximum multiplied by a damping factor to do with this exponential. And the interesting thing that comes in happens when you put in real numbers, because the cyclotron radius is related to the Fermi vector. For a typical metal, a Fermi vector would be about half an inverse angstrom. Again, these details don't matter to non-specialists. The punchline's coming in a moment. A standard large magnetic field for a laboratory would be about 20 tesla, or if you're slightly poorer, about 15 tesla. These price things go up exponentially in price with field. If you put in the numbers then for really a very high purity material, so if you manage to grow a complex oxide with a mean free path of 1,000 angstroms, you're extremely pleased with yourself, right? That's a very, very good result in terms of what that's telling you is that you have no material defect for hundreds of lattice spacings in all directions. And to achieve that in something with many atoms and many possibilities for structural problems and everything isn't easy. If you manage that, you would be quite proud of yourself. But when you put it into this exponential with the real parameters, it still means that in your quantum oscillation measurement, when you're trying to study the physical consequences of the quantization, you'll be measuring about 6 parts in 1,000 of what you could have seen. Okay? And now let's go to a reasonable purity material. And if a chemist first synthesizes a new oxide metal, they would again be extremely pleased to be able to synthesize one whose mean free path was 100 angstroms. So at first time out, if you have tens of lattice spacings in all directions without any defects, you're very pleased. You put that into this exponential and you discover that you're about 10 to the minus 23 suppression factor. In other words, you have absolutely no chance of seeing the oscillations. So you can do the back thing. You can try and observe the oscillations. Once you have them, you can back calculate to the mean free path, which is an objectively determined number, which is telling you something objective about the purity of your material. There's also a lot of other nice physics you can do, but at the moment, let's just treat them as a caliper on how good these oxide metals can be. So if you're going to try and work with bad metals, you see the field comes in inverse here to the cyclotron radius. So either you're going to need fantastic materials or absolutely enormous magnetic fields to see something, or as we'll see later, maybe a combination of the two. So the first, not the first oxide that that ever showed quantum oscillations, but the first complex oxide looking anything like a high TC material that showed quantum oscillations was strontium-2, ruthenium-04. And both Steve and myself actually had a great fun doing that experiment on a rig that he'd built at Cambridge. Everything you're seeing there is the effect of Landau quantization. It looks like a black lump just because the frequencies are quite high. If you blow up, you see that you have a complex signal with many frequency components to it. Again, the details don't matter at all. What it tells you is that you understand the quasi-particles in this material, and you can back calculate to the idea that in the best ones, you can now achieve mean free paths of the order of 1 micron. So 10,000 angstrom mean free paths can be achieved in this complex oxide. Quantum oscillations don't have to come in very high frequencies. They can also come in much lower frequencies. So there's some more recent data from calcium-containing ruthenate. It's not now just an isolated result to have it from one particular ruthenate metal. So all the time, that was done in the mid-1990s. But all the time, there was this nagging thing in the field that nobody had ever seen quantum oscillations. They'd never seen this type of signal from a high-temperature superconductor itself. I have to say that this one nagged at me because the original thesis project that I was given in 1987 was to do this experiment. I had enough sense to refuse and demand a change to another project because, as you see, it was eventually done precisely 20 years later, so I'd have been one of those graduate students with a long white beard before it got done. And this is a Canadian story because this was done in measurements. It was done in France, but by a Canadian-led group, the group of Louis Taillefer, who used to be here, and on Canadian-grown samples from the UBC group of Bon, Liang, and Hardy. And just seeing these oscillations in the cuprates was a major breakthrough. Possibly it's been a slightly disappointing one in that it hasn't led maybe to the fullest level of physical understanding that we'd hoped that we'd be able to get to, but it's still an unfolding story, and what it certainly has done is to allow us to put numbers on just how pure the cuprates can be, and again, mean free paths of several hundred angstroms are now being achieved in cuprate single crystals, so we're beginning to get up to the levels of purity where you've got to take these things seriously. I told you at the beginning about strongly overdoped cuprates, the so-called overdoped ones, where you've got a superconductor, but it's very close to a conventional metal. And people even wondered how conventional the metal was. And so there was, even after the first observation of quantum oscillations in the cuprates, the Landau quantization in the cuprates, it was going to be vital to try and get to one of the fully metallic ones and see whether you still had something that you could understand over in that region of what's called the phase diagram. So in order to show you that, I thought it would be nice to show you, this is the results of some beautiful experiments done again in France, but led by the group of Nigel Hussey, then at Bristol University. He took some crystals that our group had worked on back in the 90s, and they went to a very high field source, and they studied one form of its resistivity, which is shown here. There's the superconducting transition at low fields. There's the resistivity going up to high fields. There's the magnetic torque. Again, the superconductivity is manifesting itself in this irreversibility at very low fields. But if you got to very high fields, you have a reversible signal. And in order to sort of tell you what it can be like looking for quantum oscillations when you have you're right at the borders of what's possible, I'll just blow up the highest field data here, and you see that right at the highest fields, you have these minute oscillations that you're just able to resolve over the noise, both in the resistivity and in the torque, and they're giving you equivalent information. Now, the other thing to note, though, and so this was, it turns out that you can back calculate from the information you got there to really establish that there are no funnies going on in the strongly overdoped metallic state of the cuprates. There you have a metal, which is a reference point that you can understand from which you can begin to approach the superconductivity and hope to understand that better, too. So something else, though, to mention to you is that the scale there, all of the oscillations from which the physics were taken happened between 50 and 60 Tesla in a pulsed magnetic field in Toulouse. And those of you who've ever used pulsed fields from the sort of start of that field, I tried to do some experiments with some colleagues in the States in the 1990s on this, and sure, you could get the high fields, but you couldn't get anything like a respectable signal-to-noise ratio on your data. So the data were very noisy, and they were so noisy that they were just covering up the signal that you could have seen altogether. What Cyril Proust achieved that enabled this type of measurement was to bring DC static field noise levels to a pulse field, and it was a tremendous technical achievement. So I'd just like to tell you a little bit about their lab, because I think it also scopes to you, it gives you a better feeling for how demanding these experiments are. Yes? Yes? What you do is, again, it's just scientists, physicists are very good at sort of piggybacking on other people's technology. So what revolutionized the field of torque was actually AFM. So the use of atomic force microscopes meant that people were developing tips which were piezo-resistive, so that as these very, very fine tips move, you get a slight change in resistance. So if you take one of those tips and you glue a tiny sample on, the sample was probably 50 microns by 50 microns, you glue a sample onto that tiny tip and you move it slightly off axis with respect to the field, as you apply a field to your sample then wants to torque. As it torques, it changes the lever deflection and you measure a change in resistance. So in the old days, I have to say my kids refer to the 1980s as olden times, which kind of upsets me a little bit. But in olden times, you used to have to do torque measurements either by measuring the torsion of a wire or later by using laser interferometry to detect the slight changes in position of a sample which was hanging from such a torsional wire. Nowadays, it's become very easy to make these things tiny and to work at very low temperatures, and so that's how that measurement was done. So let me say a few words about capacitor-driven pulsed field or pulsed magnetic fields. The idea is very simple. You take a capacitor and you charge it up, and you have a coil through which you can discharge to Earth, and you have a switch, and you have some remote way of removing yourself from the scene of the action while you hit that switch. You close the switch, the capacitor discharges through the coil, and you get a very large field pulse. And basically, there's the cryostat that these Toulouse measurements were done in. The sample was sitting somewhere here in the coil. You had cryogens and everything around it. And what you achieve when you hit the switch would be a very sharp rise time up to the maximum field. This is a particular example where it was somewhat below 60 Tesla, but it's regular to go up to about 65 now in that lab. Having followed the very high rise time, you have a fall time, which is a little bit more gradual, depending on the parameters you're using for your experiment. And what you do is you study the response of the sample to that time-varying magnetic flux that's passing through it. The principle is very simple. The cryostat doesn't look all that different to everything else. I mean, a man standing there would be just higher than the top of the blue bit. But what you have to realize, and all that you have to do then is find this capacitor, but the capacitor is that entire room there full of extremely high-powered electronics, and the base of the cryostat is hidden somewhere around about there. It's going through the floor to be a tiny, almost unseeable, invisible feature at one bit of the room. And the powers involved here are enormous, and there probably isn't a pulse field lab in the world that hasn't had a major fire when they get something wrong with these capacitors. So, you know, just to try and scale for you, the technological achievement, two things. One is the achievement of growing really good samples, but one cannot underplay the technological achievement of producing regularly these really high fields and being able to do it in such a way that you can still do a proper signal-to-noise measurement. I once did an estimate, so the effect that you're looking for in the magnetization, is called the de Haast-Van-Alphen effect. It was discovered in Leiden in about 1930. And one way of scaling scientific progress is to realize that quickly, if you do a back-of-the-envelope calculation, you realize that the modern detectability of these oscillations is about a factor of 10 to the 15 better than the signal-to-noise that was achievable by de Haast and van Alphen in 1930. So they saw it in one special set of circumstances, but huge numbers of advances have been required since then in order to get up to the levels we're working at today. So that's part one of the survey of the basic science you can do. What about the technology? So I hope the basic science is proving to you that in a series of different systems, oxides are coming of age. We can grow them very pure, and we can quantify that we can grow them very purely. So what about trying to use them? Well, in that context, I don't work on this field at all, but it's always been interesting to try and keep my eye on the developments in it. And so semiconductor technology and heterostructures have been based on, one of the standard things is to grow heterostructures of aluminium arsenide and gallium arsenide. And back in 1995, this was about a state-of-the-art growth. So you could see a TEM, transmission electron microscope picture, showing you the two layers and showing you some interfacial roughness. Okay, now in the semiconductor game, you're allowed to get away with a certain amount of interfacial roughness because the wavelength of the particles, of the waves you're looking at, is quite long. So this was absolutely adequate for that game. In the oxides, the wavelengths you'll be looking at will be much shorter, so you're going to need to compete with that sort of interfacial purity. You need better interfaces. And by 2001, this paper, this report from Schlamm's group, then at Penn State, was about the state of the art. You could see that you had interfaces which were actually better than the typical interfacial quality of a semiconductor heterostructure, even back in 01. But they need to be better still, and you could see if you've got very good eyes and you're sitting near the front that these interfaces, although they look very good, they're not perfect if you look at them in detail. By the end of the decade, things were changing a lot. So this is data from about 2010 that Harold Wang sent me. He's now at Stanford, and all the microscopy for this stuff was done by the Mueller group at Cornell. And the great thing here is if you look on the right, you'll now see essentially absolutely perfect interfaces, atom by atom. And the thing I enjoy is that this wasn't an accident. They had a laser fluence control which was able to take them from really rather bad multilayers to very good ones, so it's becoming deterministic. It's not a question of just chancing and relying on luck. It's not just at Stanford that this is being done. Here's broadly equivalent quality achieved by the Mannhardt group then at Augsburg and now at Stuttgart. So we're beginning to bring things together. We think we've got single crystals with really high purity. We have the ability to make seriously competitive interfaces. So what more could we need? Well, you might want to be a little bit cynical about this because you'll again notice there aren't many dots on this picture, so there aren't many atoms involved. And not many transmission electron microscope guys got famous by publishing their worst data, right? By publishing their worst pictures. So what you'd want to know is this kind of quality going to macroscopic length scales or not? And here, there's a paper now from 2009 from Wang's group published in Nature that I think is very important for the field, because now what they've done is they've set up a two-dimensional electron gas that exists only at the interface between these two oxides that they've been trying to grow in these multilayers. And for the first time, they were able to observe the quantum oscillations in that interfacial gas, which, again, hasn't proved that they're as good as the gallium arsenide 2-degs, but it has at least been able to put a number on it. And the mean free path is, again, in that magic sort of 100 to 500 angstrom range, depending on what they do. So again, it's quantifiable purity, and once you can quantify it, you can begin to improve it. It turns out that these are particularly complex oxides, and in Japan, they've been doing something which is even more spectacular in some ways. They've been working with magnesium zinc oxide. For the specialists, that's based on S levels, and so the conditions for the purity are somewhat less stringent materially. But first of all, they observed the integer quantum Hall effect in these systems, and then later they observed the fractional quantum Hall effect, which was seen in the mid-80s in semiconductors, but it requires very, very high mobilities of at least 100,000 centimeters squared per volt second. So here's an oxide multilayer, an oxide interface two-dimensional electron gas with mobilities about 140,000 centimeters squared per volt second. And I believe that Kawasaki is approaching pushing the million now in molecular beam epitaxy-grown multilayers, which these are numbers that I don't believe non-specialists in the oxide field would have thought the oxides could support. So again, it's showing that while they're still behind, oxides are coming in terms of the basic material parameters that are required to really make these things work. There's also maybe more to come from the natural world, because here's a naturally occurring oxide which can be grown by not even in the special image furnaces. It's called palladium cobalt oxide. And here's the resistivity that we did some work on it in collaboration with our Japanese collaborators a couple of years ago. And you'll see that it doesn't superconduct, but it's no exaggeration that the resistivity is damn close to zero for a prolonged period down below about 15 Kelvin. And it's almost flat below 15 Kelvin as well. And this is a sort of gift from nature. In this oxide, where you haven't made any particular attempts to grow a clever multilayer, that resistivity is so low that that would be a mean free path of about 20 microns in that oxide at low temperatures. And that 20 micron mean free path at quantum Hall densities would correspond to at least a mobility of 2 million centimeters squared per volt second. So again, I don't think anybody's ever tried to make multilayers of this material, but certainly it occurs to me that in terms of the purity required, maybe nature's given you a gift there, and maybe it would be a good idea to start trying to do so. So I told you I was going to oscillate between technology and pure science, and I can see that I've got about 10 minutes left. Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah, no, you like to finish at 5, right? So I've got my timer going on. I'll try and be relatively quick. Now we're back to pure physics. And how would you think about trying to stimulate entirely new physics once you're able to grow interesting materials like this? And one way to think about this is something called a quantum critical point, which I mentioned in the introduction. And the idea of a quantum critical point is the following. Imagine you just took iron, right? We've been using iron or its derivatives to its magnetism has been guiding compasses for thousands of years. What's happening in iron is that up at some high finite temperature, you have a non-magnetic state. And then you make a second order phase transition at the Curie temperature into a magnetic state, and the symmetry is broken, and everything is, there's a preferred direction, et cetera, and you've got a compass at temperatures below that. In the 70s, theorists began to ask, would it be possible to do something to iron or to other materials that would allow you to take that TC and drive it down towards T equals zero? If you were able to take that phase transition from a magnet to a non-magnet to be at T equals zero, then the thermal fluctuations that normally drive the phase transition can't possibly be operable. It must be quantum fluctuations that are driving the phase transition. And so what you've got there is what's called a quantum critical point. And basically, what you can think of that doing is frustrating the kinetic and potential energy in the material down at T equals zero due to some quantum competition. So that was always believed to be of tremendous interest. And one of the classic papers of the field came from taking antiferromagnetic metals, pressurizing them to take their TC all the way down towards T equals zero, and discovering a form of new unconventional superconductivity in the vicinity of where the phase transition would have reached zero. So the idea there is that as you've tried to create this quantum critical point, you're trying to do rather strange things to the entropy of the system as you're going down to its vicinity. So you're causing the density of states to diverge in that area. When you cause a density of states to diverge in a solid, there's a very high chance that it's going to go and do something else to get away from that divergence. And here, the way it got out of it was to order into a new superconducting state. And this idea of taking these quantum critical points and looking for new forms of order around them has become de rigueur in the field. It doesn't always create a superconductor. Sometimes it creates something else. And here we have bilayer, another ruthenate metal, not like the ones that I was originally mentioning to you, but another one where you can grow these extremely pure compounds in the image furnace. And so we grew these very pure compounds a number of years ago in my group, and we discovered that when we measured some properties, we saw a magnetic field dependence of the behavior of those properties that looked as if we were tuning towards a quantum critical point. So we looked on in more detail, and we discovered that if we took all of these pointers of these contours seriously, we'd have expected a quantum critical point at just under 8 Tesla. Instead of finding the quantum critical point, though, we discovered a region of phase space where something else was happening. It wasn't superconductivity, but it was delineated by quite well-defined phase boundaries. And to our amazement, a few years later, we realized that if you measured the electrical resistivity, say, along the x and the y direction, the crystal was fourfold symmetric, so you absolutely expect to get the same resistivity along x, along y, or along actually any of the directions in the plane. That's a feature of fourfold symmetry. We got what we expected outside the phase at low fields and at high fields, but within the new phase, the transport, even though the crystal showed no observable deformation, the transport went strongly twofold. And it turns out that, or the other vital thing to mention, is that this, again, was only seen once we were able to increase the mean free path in the samples to several thousand angstroms. So this is another case of where purity mattered, but here it mattered not for technological reasons, but for the reasons that we were able to see something that was completely unobservable in lower purity samples. And it turns out that this fourfold to twofold type behavior is probably explainable by the formation in the interacting electron system of a preferred direction. And there are two ways to think of that for the specialists, either in K-space or even in real space, where you develop some sort of a preferred direction. And that preferred direction, so directional but not translational order, is a signature in a liquid crystal of the formation of a so-called pneumatic liquid crystal. And it now appears that we have analogs of pneumatic liquid crystals happening in solids. They've been seen in semiconductors. They've been seen in some of the parts of the cuprate phase diagram. They've been seen also near superconductivity in some of the new iron arsenides, as well as in this ruthenate. But the key message is that in some limits, you're able to get this entirely new and pretty unexpected physics happening. And it happens, again, when you're able to take these complex materials, and it will only happen when you've refined them to a certain level. And it's this issue of refinement for discovery and refinement for utilization, which I've tried to make the thread that running through the talk. So that's all I really wanted to say. I was told I need to finish before 5, and I've just about made it. If I speak quickly, oxide metals have advanced enormously from the days when people like me were being shown rocks in lecture theaters. Right, and they're now at levels of purity which are entirely competitive with other interesting systems in intermetallic compounds, et cetera, et cetera. They're even reaching levels of purity which are competitive with semiconductors. Because of that, and because the advances are being driven jointly by experiment and theory, they're a fantastic playground. And the always sitting behind this is the increasingly realistic prospect of being able to exploit them. So it's not what drives me, but I think it's worth realizing it's why your government and my government and the German government should continue to invest in this kind of field of research. I think the progress is a lot faster than people believe from outside the field. And I hope I've given you some flavor of that today. So thanks for your attention.